Well, let's call this meeting to order for the CMSA regular meeting. Start with pledge.
Pledge allegiance to the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we have roll call.
Okay. Eli Beckman?
Here.
Dean Giovanni?
Here.
Michael Borstein?
Yes, ma'am.
Doug Kelly?
I am here.
And Dan Hilmer?
Here.
Thank you.
Okay, open period for public participation. Seeing nobody in the audience, we'll move on to item four, the consent calendar. I would take a motion to approve the consent calendar.
Approve the consent calendar.
I have one item to pull real quick, and that is the...
Can we please have your name and...
Oh, yeah, my name is Jason Dowen. I'm the John Lander. Item B, the treasurer's report attached to that is the account disbursement register. You're just looking at it a little closer this morning with our board chair. There's a couple of minor edits that we want to make just for the record because it's because something we file away. So on page one, about midway down, there's a couple of checks to Team Gelati and one to Topline. It says professional services, but that it's not. Those are construction contracts, so we're going to strike that. Then on page three, the second to last kind of direct deposit is to Tom Gaffney as a stipend for a board meeting, and that's supposed to say finance committee meeting, not a board meeting. So a couple of little minor edits there for the record.
Okay, making those edits.
I move with those edits.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Passes. Okay, moving along to item five, the proposed budget for fiscal years 2020 and 2021. This is an adoption of our FY 20 and 21 biennial budget. Jason?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So this is, the budget. It's essentially the same budget with the numerical values and figures and amounts that you saw last month during the budget presentation. And there are a few minor changes in terms of accounts, and there are some various other revisions that we're going to make before we finalize this and submit it to the Government Finance Officer Association for consideration of this Distinguished Budget Presentation Award. So in terms of the numerical changes, on the mostly all the accounts are the same. On the operating side, we had the representative employee operations and mechanical technicians positions with a 2.5% salary increase that the board proposed last month was accepted by the union, and that was approved in the consent calendar. That's included in the budget, and that has about a cost of $53,000 for salary and a few benefits that are also tied to payroll. Then the biosolids land application reuse fee with Synagro, that went up by CPI for the Bay Area, about 3.8%. That was included. And then our uniform contract, that was approved last month in the consent calendar. It had a slight reduction of about $1,500, so we included that in the budget. And that's pretty much on the operating side. On the capital side, there were two adjustments. One was the $400,000 cogeneration system major offsite overhaul. We moved that from FY21 to the beginning of FY20 to help fund, the repair work that we need to get done. And then the cogeneration design fee, we adjusted slightly to include the additional funds that are in the design agreement because we included the pre-purchase, contract preparation and technical specifications as part of the final design based on the board's approval last month. Then on the financial forecast, so that's at the end of the budget, there's a 10-year forecast with a lot of different line items and assumptions for growth over time. And there was one change. We had a newer CalPERS actuarial valuation report, and we looked at the unfunded accrued liability and the normal rate in the outer years, and we included those in the financial forecast. And they were quite a bit lower than what we had in there from a two-year older valuation report. So in terms of the forecast, that saved us about $1.3 million over the 10-year period for pension costs. Then, of course, once we get the new valuation report, probably in a couple years, then we'll update that again and we'll let you know what it is. So those are the changes to the amounts and values in the budget. So going forward, if the board adopts this, what we'll do before we finalize it, before the beginning of fiscal year and submit the GFOA, we'll take one last review on the GFOA sections in here, which is all the various, you know, language about the agency, the JPA, key performance indicators, things like that. We're going to include the board-approved OPEB funding plan in the exhibit to the budget. We're going to, there's board member appointment dates in a couple places. We're gonna have those as the original appointment dates, not the appointment dates from the last letter we received from the agencies. And the financial policy manual will be included also as an attachment. All the terms proposed will be changed to adopted. And the Palmer contract that was approved in the consent calendar, that's a 4.5% increase. We'll reflect that in the budget on the operating side, in the operations department budget. That's about $7,000 and $5,000 increase for FY20 and FY20 respectively. Then the one thing I would recommend that we add to the budget here is another $100,000 for electricity procurement next fiscal year.
Unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the numbers for electricity procurement in the budget right now, they're based on us not exporting and continuing to import a little bit of power. But once the engine's rebuilt and it's operational and we increase the organic waste program and we start delivering power, we won't be purchasing any. So we may have enough in there for the electricity procurement, but just in case, I'd recommend adding another $100,000. Then we'll keep you posted, you know, over the course of the year what that amount is that we expend. And the reason that wasn't in the staff report is just because we looked at, there's a matrix in front of you with all the different options to repair or replace the engine. And we looked at, you know, how long it would be out of service and figured out the energy procurement costs. And we probably don't have enough in the $400,000 capital account to cover all the energy procurement. So we figured that out this afternoon. So that's why I'm recommending that we add another $100,000 to the operating budget.
And where will that, those funds come out of? Reserves?
If we expended everything in the budget, operating budget, it'd just come up from the capital, unfunded capital reserve, it'd just be transferred in. But it's like we always have, you know, some unexpended funds at the end of the year, so it's likely that if we had to tap into that $100,000, you'd just, you know, come from various other accounts, it's all fungible within the year.
Yeah. You just do a budget transfer?
Yeah. So I can answer any questions you have with the budget or plans to make some minor adjustments in the next few weeks before we submit it to the GFOA.
I would just be curious, could you just sort of qualitatively tell us, like, how much of a hit is this unfortunate mishap with our coach and engine to the agency financially? I don't need numbers because they're all here, but just, like, yeah. is this a serious, maybe crisis is a strong word, but...
You know,
or is this well within something that's in our capacity to absorb?
Well, it's pretty significant mm-hmm. event, and it's going to take a lot of time and effort to get, you know, staff time to have it, you know, remedied. But in terms of financial impacts, we had money in the capital program in the reserves already for a major overhaul. Now this is adopted, we just move that forward, you know, a year, and that'll cover. Hopefully, yeah. Nearly all the costs. So the financial implication should be pretty minor. Mm-hmm. That's what we're hoping based on the numbers we have now and mm-hmm. everything you guys see in that matrix. Mm-hmm.
And also, so, one thing that we were talking about yesterday is it's a financial hit, but it is not a hit to the objective of this agency, which is taking care of the effluent and making sure it's safe to get out the back door. That's not affected, not even a
right.
little bit. It's
right.
completely a financial hit.
Absolutely.
And it's not really financial, because what we talked about at the last meeting was moving up the purchase of the new cogen for the very purpose that this one needed to be renovated, mm-hmm. and we didn't want to wait a year for it to be renovated, because it was going to get blown up. So we made a whole plan to pre-purchase the new cogen and have it installed, which we've approved. And then we were going to fix this one. We were going to renovate this one. So we're really not out anything. As you're saying, we're just moving from next year to this year. So it's really not a hit at all. And in the long run, I don't know, maybe it'll be a little bit more expensive because as opposed to maintenance. But those maintenance fees were pretty high anyway. But because of this, I think it'll be like the $6 million man. It'll be better, you know, than and it's the backup unit, but it'll be there for when we have to repair the new one. You know, it's warrants, it's ongoing repairs, which it takes it out of service. So, you know, it's unfortunate it happened. And I was saying one of the most kind of weird things is we had a ribbon cutting today at West Valley Sanitary, and our general manager mentioned, you know, I hear that CMS, because the green energy people there, Marine Green Energy people there, said, I hear congratulations in order because Central Marin started selling power to Marine Green Energy this week, which was true, and I didn't want to correct him because it was true. It lasted 27 minutes, I think.
Yeah, no, that's great. I asked the question mainly for the benefit of the public. And one thing, since you said that it doesn't affect our core mission, and also, as I noted in my call with Jason yesterday, fortunately does not affect the secondary mission we have set ourselves on, which is providing renewable energy, because it doesn't ultimately impact our longer game plan in terms of, you know, procuring a new cogeneration engine that will allow us to supply renewable energy. So there's that as well. It's an unfortunate event, but not a crisis.
it was a very planned event, actually. That it was supposed to occur.
Well, I think
a year and a half from now,
we're on the energy we have to buy.
Exactly. Yeah.
But the amount of energy we have to buy maybe just slightly increased because we already had that factored into the downtime when it's already included in the capital cost. Which we're going to spend now, and we included energy downtime or energy discrepancy for that. So it's all really covered. I think maybe if we had $400,000 and if we choose one of these options, we're really only spending about $13,000 more.
Yeah, if all the cost estimates are correct and things are delivered on time, and that's true. Yes. Yeah.
It just looks ugly.
So this is an opportunity to provide comments to Jason and ask questions and provide direction. So,
Mr. Hillman, question. I recognize the once you get out past year five, there's room for things that will happen. But could you talk a little bit about year seven and eight in the capital improvement program and the shortfalls that are shown in the...
Right now the capital program isn't fully funded for 10 years, and the we've talked about that before, you know, with the finance committee, and when we constructed the revenue plan, the intent was to, you know, have a 5-year revenue plan to cover the capital for the 5 years in operations, and then have a debt issuance at the end of the 5th year to cover capital for the couple other outer years, and then to develop another revenue program and bring that to the board, working with the member agencies collaboratively. And that would provide funding for those outer years of operations, which are some deficits on that, and also in the financial forecast, and also for those outer years of capital. So, but using pay-as-you-go as much as we can.
And it's our long-standing practice to look at these in 10-year time frames.
We've been doing that for probably the last 10 years, yeah, and just updating, you know, the forecast and the CIP each year.
I understand. Thank you.
Sure.
And from the finance committee's standpoint in helping develop that capital improvement plan, we have looked at, as a basis, our master plan, which Jason completed, with staff completed in the last year, and all those projects are loaded in. And that's a good segue into one of the bullet points I'd like to add, like on page 8 of the proposed language, is a bullet point that speaks exactly to that, that calls out upgrading and replacing capital assets for reliable and long-term operations of treatment facilities and minimize cost to our ratepayers. So I'd like to have that as a bullet point in here, because that is one of our major agency objectives, is we're approaching this plant's age is such that we have to start doing major capital improvements to keep it going for another 30, 40 years. And we're right at that age of a plant's life cycle where that's what we're embarking on right now with these new debt issuances that we have planned out for in FY21 and then in FY24, 25?
23.
23.
23, yeah.
So I'd like to highlight that, because that's, and we're also calling out, I'd like to add a sentence at the bottom of that paragraph, the final paragraph about the FY20 and 21 budgets, is that the agency currently plans to issue additional debt in FY21 to fund the replacement and upgrades of significant capital assets, as well as increasing capital power delivery system reliability. Because we are spending a significant capital investment on renewable energy and exporting power. So that's, and that's a major hit to our capital budget, which we're selling debt for. So I'd like to add those two comments.
Could I copy that?
Yeah.
Can you also add in there maybe the Larkspur withdrawal will be processed by then?
In the 5-year or 10-year plan?
The
10-year plan.
Let's take that up at a... As another report there.
Joking.
So anyway, I'd like to add those in, and I will provide you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And then if there's any other spot in here where we talk about debt issuance, I don't know if there's an opportunity to add a sentence in there, but if you read, when you do your final edit,
sure.
Find something, and then you can...
We'll add or modify as appropriate to align with that language. Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from the board? We're ready for...
No.
No questions?
Okay. No questions, comments?
I'll move the staff recommendation.
Excellent. That we adopt the agency's FY 20 and 21 budget?
Yes, sir. We provided comments and we've given direction.
All in favor?
With the $100,000 increase on the
correct.
On the
yeah, level. Correct.
Okay.
Everything you talked about.
Okay.
As discussed.
With all the final revisions. Okay.
And with your ability to go in and edit as needed without significant changes.
Okay, yeah. No changes to numerical except the two items we mentioned, yeah.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Great, thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Item 6 is the cogeneration system installation project final design. This is a recommendation to approve a professional service agreement with Royal Engineers to prepare the final design contract documents.
Okay. So as you know, back in March, we completed the pre-design work for the cogeneration project, and we had a presentation to the board on that. And you authorized us to move forward with the final design and to bring a contract with Royal Engineers for the final design to the board. And we said we'd do that by tonight. And you also asked us to have the pre-design peer reviewed, and we brought in Black and Beach, and they did that, and they had some comments, and those were provided to Corollo and considered within the final design scope. And then last month, you authorized a pre-purchase of the cogen system, which has been incorporated into the final design. And so attached to the staff report is the professional services agreement with Corollo. Actually, it's not attached to the staff report. It's like sent out by email, and you have a handout. So this has the professional services agreement, and then the scope fee and schedule attached.
Okay.
I gave you a Michael one yesterday.
Yeah.
Oh.
Do you have this one?
No,
you So then, so the fee is $570,000, which is about 9% of the construction cost, which is pretty good. The schedule has been accelerated a little bit. So right now it's being shown as completed by the end of the year. So if this is approved by the board, we would have a design kickoff meeting tomorrow with Corollo to start the design process up. We would bring the cogeneration selection evaluation criteria matrix to the board in September, just so you can see the different criteria that we're going to use to select the engine and the weighting, get some feedback on that. Then in October, we'd likely bring a recommendation to procure an engine from one of the manufacturers of a certain size. So that happened in October. Then by January, if everything goes forward with final design schedule, we would have before the board a accepting the design contract documents or the construction contract documents and a recommendation to authorize public bidding for the construction contract. So I could answer any questions you have.
Well, we discussed this yesterday, and I think this makes sense. I don't know. I think we
chat about it yesterday. I don't think we have any questions today, unless anybody else does.
Was Cobble purchased by somebody else?
I'm not aware of that. No.
Okay. What was the one that we had? I think they were. Okay.
RMC was purchased by another company, Witter and Kern. And CH2 Mill was purchased.
Yeah. Yeah. That was
Jacobs, maybe? I'm not too. Yeah. But Corolla is still Corolla.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to see this moving forward. I think your staff did a good job of bringing the cost in with Corolla as we asked about when we approved moving forward with them to negotiate a contract. So pleasant. It's nice to see that the 8-9% cost range on their. On their final costs on this, and also just the streamlinedness of this, just going from a strong technical memorandum, pre-design report that's been peer reviewed, just to go straight into the get the 90% going is it'll move this project along a lot quicker.
Yeah, that was what we're hoping.
Yeah, so good. I'm very happy to see this move forward.
One question. CMSA staff is part of the project management?
Yes.
So when the consultant reviews third-party components of the design, say shop drawings, does the project management staff have a review component in there, or is it just left up to the consultant?
You're referring to when the consultant is submitting design documents for review at the agency?
When shop drawings come in.
So that's the general contractor is looking at purchasing a piece of equipment that's in the specifications for the job.
Yeah.
They'll submit, the shop drawings or submittals, drawings, technical information. Sometimes our staff will review those. Sometimes if it's more of a technical nature, like a lot of times instrumentation, control systems, we'll take a look at it, but then we'll send it to the design engineer to look at under a separate engineering services during construction contract.
So are those, I wouldn't expect to see any of that outside the consultant's scope and describing here, but those review?
That would be something that would be a...
Those take place.
Once we award a contract, concurrent to that, we'd bring an amendment probably to this contract for the engineering services during construction, which includes all of the special inspections on site, submittal reviews, preparation of record drawings indicating what final construction looked like, any other type of special activities that we need the design engineer to perform during the construction phase. So that would be a separate contract or a separate amendment to this contract. And the reason it's not attached is some agencies will have that as part of the final design. They'll have a separate task for that. And we don't do that because you don't really know the final scope of the construction until the design's done. So we want to have that finalized before we negotiate a scope and a fee for that additional work.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any further questions on this? Comments? I will entertain a motion to approve the professional services agreement.
We approve the professional services agreement with Corolla Engineers to prepare the final design contract document for the cogeneration system installation project and authorize the general manager to sign it.
I'll second it.
Moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Yes, that's excellent. Thank you. So I won't cancel that design meeting tomorrow. We'll have that.
Okay, item 7 is the cogeneration system capacity selection. This is for us to the board to select the capacity of the new cogen system engine.
Okay. Yeah, so we've talked about this a couple times in the past briefly at the board meetings, where we talked about the different power purchase agreements available through MCE, the different sizes of engines, and each time we talked about it, I said we didn't have to really get into much detail or make a decision because We just need to be able to specify the size engine in the technical specifications in the contract documents. So we need that information toward the end of the design period. Since we decided to pre-purchase the engine and include it as part of final design, Kroll's told us, well, we need the selection of the engine size or capacity pretty soon, so that, you know, within the next couple of weeks. He said hopefully then they can put the package together to meet the schedule to have the submittal, have the pre-purchase contract and RFP together, you know, in the next month or so, then have that sent out to Jenbacher and Caterpillar, the two main engine manufacturers that have engines with a reliable biogas operation. So that's why it's before the board tonight, instead of, you know, several months from now, per the original plan I talked about. So just through the staff report, so we've talked about the current power purchase agreement with MCE, and now that has a limitation of 1.3 million kilowatt hours. And that, you know, we probably derived that based on the minimum demand at the agency, the maximum output of that engine, and we plugged in the 1.3 million of the contract, and that made sense at that time. And we also learned that if we select an engine size less than 1 megawatt, we could have a second small generator power purchase agreement, identical agreement form that we have now, for any capacity above the 1.3. So we could still be paid the 10.5 cents for the first 1.3, then we pay whatever the tier was for the set for the additional, you know, power delivery capacity. And right now that tier, as of when I wrote the staff report, was 8.5 cents a kilowatt hour. So if we pick, you know, the 850, the 800, or a D-rated, you know, bigger engine to a little less than a megawatt, which is a CPUC regulation, we could use that two PPA structure. And those PPAs are pretty simplistic. And even though we know that there's conflicts in them and we have issues with the terms in them, but they're easy to administer. So if we chose an engine larger than a megawatt that wasn't derated, then we'd have to use the feed-in tariff plus arrangement that or contract that they have. And we've talked about that in the past. And that's much more administratively onerous. And it has power forecasting requirements, annual, monthly, and even day ahead. And if you don't forecast your power accurately, there's penalties associated with that. So in the past, we said that staff probably wouldn't recommend moving forward with that agreement just because of the variability of the organic waste load deliveries, the energy content of those deliveries. And it's likely that we're not going to be able to accurately predict, you know, the biogas and power generation in advance every day, you know, during the year and during the term of the contract. So all of this is summarized in this table on page 2, where we have the existing engine with its structure and the revenue for if we maxed it out and sold all the power at 10 half cents. Then we have the two PPA arrangements for the 850. I didn't show the 800 here because it's lower revenue than the 850, and the board talked in the past about having the most capacities we can. So the 850 with the two agreement structure, be about $205,000 revenue. Then if we could derate the 1100 or the 1065 to something right below a megawatt, and you see if we did the 1065 or the other one, it'd be $319,000 in revenue. And then if we use the FIT plus, currently that's at 7.5 cents. Kilowatt hour that in that tier. So those are the two values there for the 1065, 1100, the 305, and the 328. Then Dean and I were talking about what's the return on investment for the 850 and the, say, the D-rated 1065. And it was just a comparison using the 850 as the baseline. So what's the additional capital cost to get the bigger engine D-rated, and what's the return on investment? So on the 1065, it costs about $61,000 more than the 850. And if we assume as soon as we start it up, we could sell all the capacity and power, it has about a 6.5 month payback to recover that capital investment. If we bought the 1100 and derated it to 995, it costs about $148,000 more than the 850. And it's a 15.7 month payback to recover that additional capital investment, assuming, you know, that the cost estimates that we have, we're working off now, are accurate for the systems, and that we have enough biogas to get the full capacity of the engine. So those are the return on investments that Dean and I talked about earlier that I want to share with you. So from staff, you know, I think, you know, we'd recommend having a power purchase agreement that was easy to administer, so the two structured agreements, and we would recommend selecting the 1065 or the 1100 engine. And just to save the $88,000 extra dollars, the 1065 engine, So that would be the staff recommendation, but we could go with the larger size engine derated also, if you prefer that.
So, again, we spoke about this yesterday, and I don't think the 1,100-watt engine brings any more anything to the table. We're talking about 1065. You save some money on that. It can be rated up to high as 1065 someday in the future, maybe, by the way, if we derate it. Maybe things will change in 5 years or 6 years or 7 years. But I think this, both on investment and return on investment, is the best bang for the buck and the easiest to administer and the easiest one to go under the MCE rules that we currently have.
Right. I mean, the only reason that we might choose a derated 1100 over a derated 1065 is if we were to think as a board that it's relatively likely that state law will change or state regulations will change and allow us to utilize the full capacity of our engine. I would imagine that we're all fairly skeptical about how soon that might happen, if ever.
Not soon, but here's it.
The other issue with that is we've got that lovely little test digester out there. We don't even know if the state came around tomorrow and said, go for it, as much as you want, we'll use it. We don't know if our digesters can make that much biogas.
That's a good point.
Because we just don't know. But
it's also true, or am I incorrect about this, that should we find that there's changes like that in the near future, or in the kind of not so near but not so far future, we have a backup cogenerator that's going to be repaired and it'll be for backup use. Couldn't we run them simultaneously? Should that come to fruition at some point?
You know, that could happen. Yeah. So, like, as part of, you know, the new systems installation, we're going to need to engage PG&E again about another, you know, initial and supplemental review of their, you know, electrical distribution transmission system, see if they can receive, you know, up to a megawatt of power. Right now they did it for 750. And they may say it's fine, or they may say there has to be some improvements in their system, our system. So we're going to have to start that process up again. And we'll also have to talk to MCE, which is much easier than talking to PG&E, about just preparing another power purchase agreement for that second tier.
In the event of one of these threatened power shutdowns by PG&E for a huge area, would that play in any way into the selection we're making now, considerations around that?
No, because when the PG&E power is shut down, there are protective relays in our electrical system that that trip and the breaker opens up. And when that happens, we're disconnected from their system. And also the cogen shuts down. So then what we have to do is we have to start up the diesel generator, because the diesel generator responds much faster to changes in load than the biogas-fueled cogenerator. So one thing we're going to talk about with Kroll and final design is, it's not with the new engine, it would be with the backup, is that if that happened and we are disconnected for a period of time, start up the old cogen in kind of like a base load, set it at like 300, 400 kW, then have the diesel start up and track with plant demand so it can respond faster. So we have to come up with a control strategy like that. We did talk briefly during the pre-design that we could integrate the new engine into the control systems of the existing engine and the diesel system and the main control panel for the facility, but that it would be very, very complex and very expensive to do that. So we decided, let's just have the new cogen operate independently, because the backup cogen is already integrated in with the diesel. So we have that flexibility to run in base load with, you know, cogen, then variable, you know, load following, they call it, with the diesel. So that's kind of the plan if we have a long outage.
Questions? I'm trying to understand sort of bang for buck here. And I'm looking at the report. I don't see the $65,000 number in here. So am I missing it somewhere?
That's information that after Gina, Dean and I talked about from investment earlier today, I went and pulled that information out of a technical memo that was submitted with the pre-design report.
Okay, so I'm not missing it.
Oh, no, I have all these notes written down here where I did calculations and stuff. Yeah.
So am I correct in understanding that going from 850 kilowatts to 1,065 kilowatts, 315 kilowatts, costs $65,000?
Yeah, for the whole system.
For the whole system, okay.
So the system, you know, the system for like the 850, and this is the engine and all the components and the, you know, oil pumps and water pumps and radiators, all the things, it's 1.654 million, 1.354, the other one's 1.415. So it was 61 difference.
How firm are these prices?
They're just cost proposals, you know, from the vendors. So we're not going to have any firm information until we actually prepare the technical specifications and the procurement, you know, RFP package and send it out to the vendors. So this is just information they submitted with the pre-design.
In your professional judgment, is this within the margin of error that you would expect for this cost estimate? The margin of variability? It's really an error.
I don't have a good answer for that. I think the mechanical design engineer lead thought that was reasonable, you know, especially the differences. It made sense to him. But I wasn't involved in those discussions. They just asked for, give us your best costs at the pre-design level so we can incorporate it into our cost analyses, you know, for these different options for the agency.
Okay.
Did they add their 30% to 50% contingency at that? I mean, did they or did you guys inflate the
hurdle? These are numbers just from the manufacturer.
Just from them.
In the project cost, you know, there's all the various line items, then there's allowances for various things, then there's contingency factors over and profit from the general contractor into the total pre-design level construction cost estimate.
Right.
This is just one of the many line items, the biggest one.
So it's pretty safe to say then this number, when we're doing our evaluation right now, we might think of it could come in 30% higher when they actually get the bid package.
I'd be kind of surprised if, you know, the cost estimates came in higher once you have all the detailed specifications and stuff. I think they build in a lot of contingency to these numbers because things are unknown. So
yeah,
it might come in lower.
Okay, so that was my question.
That's my.
You think that the manufacturers, when they gave you this number, already had that contingency built in?
Possibly because they don't have enough design information.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just don't want to be double. Dealt in this decision-making process, you know, thinking like, oh, it's really going to be more. And, go ahead.
We'll have good numbers in September.
But this is good enough for us to be able to
make a selection. Yeah.
To select what size we could go, because the next jump up to 1,100 costs another $65,000, right? So that doesn't make sense. Right, because we're now...
Right, no, that's a really interesting thing about this pricing is that you can increase the capacity by 25% and only increase the cost by 6%, but then the next tiny jump costs the same amount. So...
Yeah, very interesting how that works. But, okay, so we understand the numbers, and it looks like the bang for buck maximum is at the derated 1,065 kilowatt engine. Okay. So now shifting gears, because I feel like I got the numbers figured out. Let's shift gears and think about disaster scenarios where Marin County doesn't have any electricity for maybe days or weeks. This will be the only place in Marin County where electricity can be generated and reasonably controlled. I mean, I suppose the solar will trip off, so it'll be gone. So this is the only place in Marin County where electricity will be able to be generated. That might be a very valuable
asset.
Service. asset to the county in a disaster scenario.
If there was a way that we could dedicate that to first responders, that would make a lot of sense. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how the grid could be rewired to facilitate that.
Oh no, we'll be an island.
Yeah.
We'll be an island. They're gonna have to come to us.
This is a whole separate policy.
Right, but it's something that we should be thinking about on how, and not just assuming. And the diesel generator is going to be out of diesel. What are we going to do when we don't have any fuel?
Yeah, so we have about 6 to 7 days of operation in the diesel generator, continuous operation. But if we use that kind of dual operational mode, mm-hmm. where we set the cogen at a high level, based on, so we use the biogas, and have the diesel, say, like, for example, 100 kW output, mm-hmm. just following load, these loads don't shift that much. Mm-hmm. We might be able to get, you know, several weeks out of the diesel fuel.
Okay.
These are 6 to 7 days, that's assuming like a 650 kW load, not just, you know, maybe 75 to 125 load following mode.
Okay.
But also, I would also think that if Marin County, this area, were to have that kind of a, excuse me, situation, our fuel stock would also fall off dramatically. Our pre-organic, pre-consumer organic waste that we receive, if the restaurants aren't open, we're not going to get the fuel stock from there. If we're getting from breweries or cheese factories, they're going to be down also. And also our fuel stock.
Well, the last answer is correct. I thought you meant at the beginning of it when you were saying countywide fuel would not go down because there'd be no electricity to pump it.
No, our
trucks might be able to provide some generation for first responders. Of course, it's all another topic. I think you should put this on the agenda because I think it's an interesting topic.
Extension cords.
Well, it's just something that we should be thinking about as we do this.
Right. I think that's really good. I really do.
A question that raises for me is this. So that would be a potential rationale for going with the 1100 instead of the 1065. So my question then is, what does that extra 35 kilowatts of capacity, what can that power? I don't know. I don't have a sense of, like, what, you know. So if somebody or Jason does have, like, a sense of what this 35 kilowatts of capacity is worth in a disaster scenario, I would.
In a disaster scenario, I think I agree with Michael said that the food waste is going to be coming in, mm-hmm. and probably the other organics won't come in, so we'll only be generating enough biogas to run the cogen for so many hours a day based on the wastewater processing. Mm-hmm. Now, the wastewater is still going to come in because the member agencies' main pump stations all have, you know, backup generators, mm-hmm. diesel generators or natural gas generators. So they'll still be able to receive the wastewater from homes and pump it to us. Mm-hmm. So it'll get here.
Until they run out of fuel.
Yeah, that's right. But as long as it comes here, we'll produce the biogas.
Mm-hmm. And we have no storage for it?
For biogas? Mm-hmm. We have storage in the digesters.
Okay.
But during a disaster, you know, we're going to need that biogas, so we'll be using more. We won't be storing any. We'll be using it as a generator,
right.
Probably.
Right, so it's not like you have 2 weeks' worth of biogas in a tank somewhere.
What would happen is it would we'd run the cogen, then the biogas would be depleted after 8, 9, 10 hours or whatever it happens to be, and then we'd have to run the diesel. Or we had it in a load following to where maybe it was shared, mm-hmm. so maybe you get, you know, 14, 15 hours out of the biogas, and then you have to wait for the microbes to eat, mm-hmm. other microbes and other fun things, and produce more biogas. Mm-hmm. So we'd have to operate it that way. Or something like that, because the biogas, once you use that volume, it's going to take a while to generate, and it's generating much slower rate than we're receiving the organics. Mm-hmm. I don't have a better answer than that right now, a general answer.
But it sounds like you're saying kind of maybe a moot point, this.
We would be able to utilize an 1100 if
right.
there was, or even the 1065, or the 750 we have. It would just be for a portion of that output.
Okay.
Due to the lack of the biogas.
And then being able to, following up on your point, Beth, is to be able to get that off-site somehow to support any other emergency operations is where, it's not like someone could drive a truck up here and we power up a truck and they go deliver it to somewhere. We have to wheel it through PG&E and then direct it somewhere.
Right, they would never let that. In a disaster scenario, the breaker's going to flip and we're done.
And we're operating as an island.
Right, we're an island. We're an island, but we've got electricity.
Yeah.
And if we're the only place with electricity on the Marin Peninsula, we're going to be real popular.
We need to get cable TV.
well,
everybody that has a generator is going to be...
Right.
One thing I did mention is that when we're not running the biogas, we can buy the natural gas and run the cogenerator natural gas. So if we had an 1100, we could run it on the natural gas. and use, even though we couldn't deliver anything more than a megawatt, if we shut down anyways, we could still run up to 1,100 for, you know, internal demand. If we had, like, say, vehicle charging stations out here, some battery systems, you know, we could charge battery systems. You know, responders or others with electric vehicles could charge up here. So that's something that could happen. We could use a bigger engine, but we run on natural gas, too.
What I'm hearing is we have our hands full in a disaster scenario, taking care of our own operation.
That's probably going to happen, yeah.
Much less trying to export to someplace else.
That I think that's true, but we should be thinking about what sort of services we could have available for others in a disaster scenario. And maybe it's just a room that people would come to and charge their cell phones.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea for a separate conversation.
Okay.
But it is germane to how big we go here today, though. That's sort of the... planning for any futures that we don't even know about today. So I think that's where two of the commissioners are coming from, is why not go bigger is what I'm hearing, and have the available capacity should we ever need it.
Jason, there's no other implications on the 1,100 kilowatts derated? I mean, it's the same as a derated 1065, except with 35 more kilowatts. Is that right?
My understanding, yeah.
Okay.
Again, what is the extra cost to go to that higher, to get 35 kW or more?
$88,000.
So that's 11 months, that's 10 months more.
But my understanding also with the
derated... That's 10 years more.
Well, if you were able to sell it all.
But it's not like the derate, it's not like we could go, oh God, we need this now. Jason, go out back and derate this and rate it back up. You have to have the company come out.
Well, yeah, that costs a little bit of money too, because they have to come out, they have to replace a turbocharger, they have to replace, you know,
turn it down,
valves, you know, that had, you know, orifices installed to prevent flows. So there's some work to get it done.
Let me clarify. The maximum annual revenue on the derated 1065 is $319,000. The maximum annual revenue is $328,000 on the 1100, so it's $8,800 a year increase.
The 1100 kW at the 328, that's assuming we're exporting the whole 1100 under the FIT plus.
Right, so now I'm concerned that we're not for $88,000 more, we're not really going to get...
When it's derated, yeah, it's not going to...
Right, because it'll be derated to the same level as the 1065. Yeah. So the question is just, is this $88,000? Now, what's $88,000 to CMSA? And is it worth giving ourselves this flexibility in the future?
It's only 35 watts.
True.
Yeah.
I kept waiting for you to get to where you're saying there's no bang for the buck.
Oh, I'm sorry. Therefore, it occurs to me that the bang for the buck on going from 1,065 to 1,100 is not there.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps sometime in the future, if we do the study with the digesters and find that we really could ultimately produce way more biogas than we are now without upsetting the digesters, and B, we can get the food source from breweries, cheese factories, and everything else, and maybe that's 5 or 6 years down the line, and we've gotten 5 or 6 years more out of this used generator that we're going to put in there, we could at some point add in another generator, a bigger one that's 30% more efficient than, anyway. So.
Or that's use good. The one that we have as the backup one to work side by side?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
So, therefore, I think it's time for us to move. I move that we authorize the general manager to purchase the 1,065 kilowatt engine that is made by who? I'm not sure.
It'll either be Jinbacher or Caterpillar. That information will come later when we have a proposal.
Okay, so 1,065 kilowatt.
Second.
Derated.
It's been moved and seconded. Final point of discussion. So you will be bringing this back to us for a actual contract to go out for advertising before it goes out, or will this is the last time we're going to see it, and then you're going to bring it back for an award later?
So the plan right now is you wouldn't see a contract going out for advertising, but you would see, we'd do that, and you'd see two things. You'd see our evaluation criteria matrix, how we're going to evaluate the different, you know, manufacturers' proposals.
And that will be in a board informational memo? Or?
It'll be something to talk about, actually. So okay. There'll be, you know, we'll have a recommendation. We'll say, this is what we're planning to do. And you can provide a comment. You might say, well, we think, you know, cost should be a higher weighting than you have down here. Or you should have the local repair facility should be, you know, higher rated. Whatever you guys think. So we'll finalize that. And then concurrent around that time, we'll be receiving proposals for evaluation. And then October, we'll have the evaluation completed with using the matrix that the board's looked at. And then we'll have a recommendation to the board in October, recommendation of a manufacturer and a size unit with a cost and a schedule and other details.
So you all have gotten the bids in?
Yeah.
Okay. So yes, if I remember correctly, we talked yesterday that this would take a little bit more than a year. Is that what we said?
You know, probably closer to 18 months before we have a brand new unit that's running and meeting, you know, emissions requirements and power, you know, somewhere around that time frame. Okay. Once we get closer to the final design, based on when the engine is going to be delivered, that schedule, the contractor may get the job done faster also. I'll have more information in terms of scheduling later in the fall once the final design is kind of getting closer. We have the contract with the engine supplier.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
It was great to see you.
I volunteer my brass band to come play for the ribbon cutting. We were such a giant hit today.
We were. They were good.
So we will be all experts in cogeneration engines by the time the night is through. So now we would like to go to item 8, which is the Waukesha cogeneration engine failure report. This is to receive the report and make a decision on either rebuilding or replacing the engine. So, Jason.
Thank you. So we had a great milestone event last Thursday. I sent an email out that we started generating, we started delivering renewable power. I sent the board the email. I sent it to MCE. Got some congratulations. We were pretty excited here.
We're excited.
And the next morning I came in. And our staff said at the 6 a.m. shift change, there was kind of a little power dip. And they went out to go look at the engine. Because there's a slight low pressure, you know, oil pressure on the engine. And it all had fallen apart out there. So I came in, you know, after my workout, all happy. So it was 8:30, and our plant manager gives me the news. It's like, oh. So after going out looking at it, and I send you guys the email, I told MCE, remember that great news yesterday? Well, it'll be a while before we deliver some power to you guys. And so that's kind of what happened. So, you know, our staff was very efficient, you know, disassembling the engine. We brought in a cogen, you know, system consultant, Bay Power, who's worked with us in the past, and they kind of, you know, did a review and failure analysis. We got the report back today from them, and we we did some research and contacted, you know, Waukesha certified, you know, repair facilities to see, do you guys have, you know, crankshafts, engine blocks, old engines, you know, the same exact model that could fit in the same spot that we reuse, you know, a lot of our components on. The staff did great work on the research. So there's some information in the staff reports about some of the research that we had done up to the time of writing the staff report. Here's some photos. So you see the picture of the engine when it was happy and all put together, then the one that's, you know, been mangled and we've taken it all apart. And then some of the components. So we have a couple components there. And the kind of rounder component, the half of the round component there is, what did Chris call that? It's like a counterbalance. So there's 16 cylinders in the engine, and each piston has a connecting rod attached to it. And that's that item on the left. And in between connecting rods, there's these counterbalance. So the rod and the counterbalance sit on the drive shaft. It's a really tight configuration. So the expert, engine cogen expert said that he believes that the counterbalance, which is held together by big bolts, it became loose. And it started to separate, and there's very, very small tolerances between the connecting rods and the counterbalances. And it just started moving and shifting around. And that caused just this chain reaction of things moving in there and deforming and bending and all kinds of other stuff that happened at 1800 RPMs, and you had a failure below two of those pistons. So those are Chris's idea to bring those here to show you. Mm-hmm. Those are pretty mangled.
Yeah.
Doesn't look good. Can't reuse those.
Why didn't anybody see the check engine light?
Get out of the minutes.
Can you paint the scene for us? Like, was it bloody carnage as soon as you step into the engine room, or did you have to start taking it apart before you saw evidence of?
It was. You know, there was oil sprayed out. I think some of the covers were knocked off, and there's some cracks. But when you looked inside,
yeah,
you know,
right.
there's these. You can see it in this photo here. This is just a little port that's about this big. And there's, you know, 16 of those in a row, 8 in a row on each side. And you can just look inside and see all the shrapnel, and it was pretty bad. I went out there again, you know, after they had it disassembled, and we have tables that big with all these just parts and debris and mangled things on it.
So that's what throwing her out looks like.
We're lucky no one was hurt.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. And you know, SCADA, there are incredible number of instruments monitoring the operation of the engine, you know, temperature, like cylinder pressures, and the only thing that happened was a slight dip in the oil pressure, just for a moment. And that was it.
You may not be able to answer this, but do you think that if, say, Waukesha or whoever it is that does the overhaul had done the planned overhaul, like, you know, prior to this happening, do you have any sense of if this is something that they might have been able to catch beforehand, or do you think it's maybe something, like, I don't even know if this is...
Yeah, well, that's good. That's a really good question, because, you know, I would think that when you're doing the bottom end overhaul, the lower piece where the drive shaft and those components are, or a major offside overhaul, that's checked. You know, those tolerances are checked, mm-hmm. you know, the torque on the bolts are checked, yeah. All that. One thing Dean and I are talking about is going forward with whatever solution we have for this engine and the new engine. You know, we have those types of overhauls, we're going to point out this event to the person we award the contract for repair to and say, this happened to us, make sure you check all these things, double check them, so we can avoid this same type of thing in the future. Just to let them know how serious it was for us. But did I answer your question?
Yeah, no, yeah.
Okay.
Can I get on to these suggestions here?
Sure.
So looking at these...
So here's the matrix for you guys.
Yeah. Looking at these suggestions... The one that makes the most sense to me, having briefly looked at these, is the number 6 at 413,000. But the key thing about that is there's two things that are important to me. One, it says 1 month ready to go. Is that right?
That's what they told us, yeah.
And the second thing is 6-month warranty. Now, I'd like a 6-year warranty, but I don't see any 6-year warranties here.
Yeah, this would be their warranty for this solution. I mean, we could engage them and, you know, purchase a longer warranty, see how much that would cost.
So there's no warranty on number 3. Number 1 is brand new, okay, so that comes with 1 year. Number 3 has no warranty. Number 4 has no warranty. Number 5 has 90 days. And then all three of the rest of them have 6 months. But this one, I guess... Procure years block from crankshaft from number 7. It's a little bit more money. One's 1 month, one's 2 months. The last one's 9 months. You know, I'm really looking at the less money and the faster time frame, because the less money is less money, but the faster time frame is less money. Less fuel being purchased.
Yeah, looking at, I agree. I think we said you look at 5 and 6. So our staff really kind of honed in on those two alternatives. So those are maintenance staff and who know have a lot of experience with you know, the Waukesha and the overhaul work, and our plant manager. So you look at the material cost, and these are the quotes. So number 6, you're paying $225 versus $148. So $225 is for the short block, and that's the whole bottom part of the engine. That's the crankshaft, it's all those components, it's everything. So with that, you would take the upper piece, which has the pistons and the liners and all that, and just stick it on with the turbochargers and, you know, all the other components. So that's $225. Or, and we purchased this from Waukesha Pierce, which is the current Waukesha, you know, manufacturer representative. And they have a facility and a contract over in San Leandro. and they've done work with us before on various overhauls in the past. Kraft, as I told some of you, was the certified manufacturer's rep back before Waukesha was purchased by General Electric years ago. So they're experienced too. So you could buy actually the whole engine from them, the whole used engine that they inspect, that they completely rebuild. So on the service, you get a whole rebuilt engine, right, delivered out here that's certified for 148, or just most of an engine from a local facility for 225. Then you look at, the startup cost, the 45, that's the same. That's having, Peterson Cat come out, they install everything, they hook it up, they get it running, emissions dialed in, follow-up work. The shipping is a little different because one's from San Leandro, one's from Ohio. Rigging, that's the cost to take our engine out and get rid of it and take the old one off the truck and get it mounted properly. Then electricity is the variance. Mm-hmm. So on 5, that's, we're looking at 8 weeks possibly. So that's 8 weeks of buying power plus the power we've had to buy between when it failed and assuming we give them some type of purchase order with our contract attorney end of this week. So we figured when it failed to the end of this week, buying power, then that 6 week time period would start at the end of this week. We kind of had to make some assumptions on time frames. Mm-hmm. So with 8 weeks, the other one we're figuring a month, at least at a month. So that's the big variance there. You're paying more for the equipment from a local supplier, but they're saying they can deliver it within the month. So that's the big cost variance there. And that's what we have no control over.
Right. So our savings is coming on purchasing less of the electricity of the deep green from MCE.
That's right.
Which brings me to a question. What would happen if we reverted to light green?
We save, I think it's 1 cent per kilowatt hour less.
So that's what? 60, what percentage is that?
I couldn't answer that because these numbers have time of use charges, demand charges, power purchase charges, and a lot of those are PG&E's, transportation delivery charges. MCE is just, a component.
Yeah, that's probably...
So it'd be less, but it'd be not that much less.
Not that much, not enough to worry about.
If I recall, our total decision cost when we went to Deep Green was like $18,000 a year.
Right, but we weren't thinking we were going to be running the whole plant on it.
Yeah, that was based on the energy procurement, estimate for the prior 12 months at that time. And that was running, a lot of hours on biogas mm-hmm. and natural gas, too.
So, but still, it's probably trivial. But so the savings comes from electricity, but we're getting sort of less product, less engine.
Yeah.
So... talk to us about the two different products. Forget about the electricity savings. Just focus on the material that will be delivered.
So one is an engine with fully rebuilt engine by Kraft. So they have one now that they sell for $47,000 as is. So what they're proposing as one of their options is that they would inspect that, then perform major overhaul on the engine, then certify it, and then they would then we'd have to go have it paid for transportation out here. Under the item 6, that's the whole lower part of the engine. So it's the block, it's the crankshaft, the bearings, all of these internal components, which are also part of number 5. You wouldn't get with number 6, all the stuff that's sitting out there right now that's kind of being suspended above the engine. So there's like all the upper components, with the cylinder heads and sleeves and pistons. And
would you get that with number 5?
Oh, yeah.
So it sounds like number 5 has more engine for our buck.
That's right, it does.
Number 6.
Well, I think also one of the issues is it's a little bit like when you're doing a remodel at your home. You have an idea, but when you remove the drywall, that whole top piece of the engine... if we bring a brand new bottom piece in and then they try to mate the top piece to the bottom piece, they might start looking in at the top piece and the whole thing hasn't been tested and it could open up another whole can of worms versus the other engine, which is the whole thing is there, they turned it on, they went over it with a fine-tooth comb, they rebuilt everything they needed and bring it out here and it works. rather than trying to make two pieces together, one which we know works, and one which, who knows what the issues between mating the two are.
Well, not to mention, who knows what in that in our existing piece may have been damaged.
By that,
yes.
So when we're talking about the guys from Ohio, we're paying shipping. I get that. Are they coming out?
I don't believe so. I think that they would overhaul the engine. They'd say, PCM would say, here's a date certain that you can pick it up. We would we talked about just before the meeting here, before Chris left, sending one of our mechanics out there to observe a couple days of the work and make sure it's all packaged up properly and mm-hmm. Load onto the truck and everything, which would be low cost when you look at a big difference of 148 to 225. Our staff initially thought, well, we really like number six because we know this repair facility. We've worked with them before. Mm. But, I point out to them, well, even if we get that craft engine out here, we're going to be contacting that repair facility, and their staff will be working on it anyways because they're San Leandro. We're working with them. The only risk would be, and I don't know how much risk it is, probably not much, because it's completely rebuilt. It's I would say it's highly unlikely that something's going to happen in 90 days or 6 months with the engine, which is going to be a warranty. The question would be if there was a warranty issue with it, how are they going to come out within a reasonable time? You could write that into the purchase contract, but then that might add to the cost. I mean, there's some of these things that we haven't had time to think about and engage them with, after the inspection and the event and preparing this, getting all this information for the board. But we could look into a lot of these things as part of the purchase.
When on item five, to get the new used engine, how new are the components on the upper portion? Is it completely redone, rings and sleeves, and the turbocharger is brand new, or is that refurbished?
So this is the whole engine less than 2 years old, or about 2 years old? 2 years of use?
Yeah, so that's
16,000 hours.
So yeah, but my understanding is there's 16,000 hours on the system.
Just 2 years.
And so they're going to take that and they're going to do a major overhaul on it, an inspection and overhaul.
What does that mean, the overhaul portion?
It's going to be, so I wish I had a mechanic here. He could explain those details to you. I'm just an engineer. I don't know all this mechanical thing. It's going to be, they're going to replace, spark plugs and filters and lubricants. They're going to make sure the tolerances between all the components are within factory specifications. They're going to make sure the cylinder heads are proper, the liners are fine, that line the cylinders. They're going to make sure the tolerances on those components are tight. Everything's the crankshaft is good, no scarring on it. The bearings are working properly, that kind of stuff. And if things aren't proper and meet your specification or show wear, they'll get replaced as part of the overhaul work. That's my understanding. That's why this cost increased from 47, just take it as it is, to 148. Take it and we're going to inspect it and overhaul it. And overhaul will probably be pretty minor on the lower end because of just the lack of hours. Most of the time you have a lot more top-end overhaul frequency, with the cylinder and the cylinder liners and the pistons than you do on the lower, components. Because it feels like we were talking a minute ago, there's not as much heat down there as in the combustion chamber.
How many hours did that have on?
That was a question I asked, and that's one some information I don't have. But it's, since the last rebuild was in 2012, I think it's probably I don't know, 60, 70,000 hours maybe. Something like that. It was 2012, early 2013, last major overhaul. It's a lot more than 16.
Yeah, so we
might be in the 40 to 70 range, somewhere in that range.
So the difference between 3 and 5 is that with option 3, we are, CMSA is doing the labor and taking on that liability, and with option 5, we're paying $100,000 to have Kraft do the labor and take on the liability through their warranty, correct?
Yeah, so on 3, it's the same engine.
Right.
So they'll do an inspection, they'll give you a report telling you what the inspection findings were, and they're replacing, the cylinder heads. So they're doing a very limited top-end overhaul work, and that's it. Under five, they're doing a full inspection, and they're also doing the major overhaul, top and bottom and other components
you,
also.
You have to have a feel for which is the best approach here. I just don't.
My staff, they think five and six will work. They like six just because it's a local facility that we're buying, that's the manufacturer representative that we're buying it from, and there's more comfort factor in that for them. When they look at the economics of it, you know, with the power purchase, assuming that the delivery dates are fine, they understand that, you know, they're kind of equivalent.
My feeling is I have no particular desire for five. Any five or six both look fine to me. I really would defer to the rest of the board as to whether we think a new engine is better. But what sticks out to me is I mentioned the month, but you know, the number five is full warranty 90 day on workmanship only, whereas the other one is twice that on hardware, you know, parts and labor. So that's just somebody's willing to give you that warranty. It means it's because when I offer somebody a warranty for a year, it's because I know something's not going to break.
But on the parts and labor on number six, is that just on the part we're buying from them, and
yes,
there's no warranty on the top half of it?
That's right.
Well, can I make a suggestion?
It's workmanship.
Can I make a suggestion? Maybe the board could authorize the general manager to choose either of these after. Can we send somebody out here to look at the and send pictures of the top half and say, what do you think? Do you think you're going to have problems fitting your part to our? I mean, I don't know.
I don't think that they're going to give us an opinion based on pictures. Mm-hmm. I think they'd need to send someone out and actually physically look at it. But this is the same model engine. So it should be where you take our top piece and it attaches to any same model bottom piece. It's the same model engine.
So sorry, did we resolve whether staff has any reservations about taking our existing half of a potentially damaged engine and mating it with half a newer engine?
I mean, that's a very good question, because that there's some risk involved with that. Well, because we're not quite sure what happened on the top half, if anything.
Right.
It could be perfectly fine. It attaches and it runs just fine, or it could be there's some problems.
Is there some way we can get, for some amount of money, somebody from San Leandro to come out here and take a look?
Yeah, we could hire someone to come and do an inspection on that.
Would they be able to tell, though, without having...
There's still
I don't know that.
The words comfort factor mean a lot to me in this discussion. And you identified those words with five.
Right.
No, with six.
With six.
Six is the...
Clarify. What did you associate comfort factor?
I'm more comfortable with six.
Is with six, but then there's like when with six, you know, we're not quite sure of the top end piece.
Right. So there's
so
two,
six could turn into five really quickly.
Right. There's comfort with a known vendor, and there's comfort with a singular product.
Well, there's that
got turned on.
I want to add
once.
One thing to the known vendor.
Sorry.
I want to add one thing to the known vendor, which I said it a second ago, but I want to highlight it, and that is double the warranty, but the warranty is also on parts. The first one is warranty only on workmanship, not parts, and it's half the time. The other one is parts and labor, twice the time. So that's where I come from more comfortable. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to be clear, I'm not particularly tied to either one of these, mm-hmm. and I'm happy to listen to the pleasure of the board and vote along
the lines
of the other board.
But they could analyze as part of six and determine they need to replace the top, too.
Yeah.
We could ask, you know... a representative from Peterson Gatt or Waukesha Pierce to come out and take a look at the top. And we could pay them a fee to look at it and give us, you know, an assessment. Do you think that is undamaged or very little damage? And it could be, you know, mounted to the short block with no issues.
Or if you don't run that until you test it.
Yeah. I just don't know.
That process would be long and expensive to get to the same place.
We'd be up $400,000.
So that 1 month keeps creeping longer and longer.
Going to the replacement.
My personal opinion is we figured.
Yeah.
You know, they show us somebody out there, they send us a video, and the guy turns on the key and it goes,
yep.
And it makes a noise, and the whole thing runs, and they put it under load, They've done their survey and rebuilt the engine as needed, and we certify it, and they certify it, and maybe talk to them about can we, you know, buy from them. You know, they certainly have a reasonable expectation it's going to go. Maybe we can buy. What would it cost us with that five scenario to extend the warranty? Would they do that for us?
We could definitely ask that. But as part of the authorization, would you want to procure a longer warranty for a certain amount if it was reasonable?
Can I?
Would that be something that can come back even, you know, next month even?
Well, we don't need to. I mean, that's going to be a minor amount of this. We trust your judgment to procure an additional warranty. I think we need to go with number five and request expedited. Every day costs us a lot of more money in electricity costs. Mm-hmm. So if they can expedite it, I mean, we'd be willing to pay to have them expedite it, and as well as add on additional warranty terms.
Jason, when we start this thing up, will it be immediately back at full capacity and supplying energy to the grid?
Yeah, so we've started up, and there's a whole startup process. I'm not familiar with the time frame of that, but it's pretty quick. But we also need to make sure the emissions were there was calibration, so the emissions met, you know, limits under biogas and natural gas to meet our permit.
Because just one thing that I'm thinking about the warranties here is that our engine blew once we cranked it up to maximum capacity. So I'm wondering, you know, if we're I don't know that in terms of the warranty, I don't know that I necessarily feel there's a difference in, like, running at full capacity for 90 days versus, you know, 120 days. Because, I feel like if you're running it at full capacity for 90 days and nothing goes wrong, in another 90 days, it seems like a weird sort of thing to me to expect that it's in that second 90 days that something might go really wrong, if that makes sense.
Well, that's warranty. It's a game of chance.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is that I don't know that I'm swayed by the warranty argument in favor of number six here.
Right, well, I'm in favor of number five. Are we ready for a motion?
Yeah.
I vote that we approve on the option listed as five on this sheet, that's procure a used engine from Kraft and have a complete overhaul performed. And that the general manager be asked to obtain an expedited schedule if it can be obtained for reasonable costs in light of the electricity costs we would be incurring, as well as a extension to the warranty and an expansion of the coverage of the warranty beyond workmanship, as well as the duration of the warranty if that can be procured on for a reasonable price.
I second it.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Seeing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Great. Thank you very much. Our staff will be happy to move forward tomorrow. That's great.
Okay, item number nine is the San Quentin State Prison Wastewater Service Agreement Amendment. This is for the board to approve the amendment to the San Quentin State Prison Wastewater Service Agreement. Any comment or direction,
Jason?
Jason?
Yes, so you recall back in March, we looked at the kind of final draft version of the new five-year wastewater service agreement with San Quentin that I'd worked with staff at Sacramento and the prison to kind of revamp the scope of work and the fee schedule. And the board reviewed it, thought it looked good. You conditionally accepted it and said once it's finalized, with the state goes through their review process, just bring it back as a consent calendar item. So that was the intention. Well, we learned that there was some miscommunication possibly between the asset management division of CDCR that worked on the contract and had the final version of it, and the Office of Business Services. And it didn't get submitted, you know, well in advance. So once I told the state that what our board decision was, they checked in and realized that it wasn't even the review queue with OBS. So they said, well, you know, may take a lot longer than, you know, July when the contract ends to have this all approved with the right signatures. So how about we amend the current contract, extend it for 12 months, and that'll give us, we'll expedite that, and that'll give, you know, OBS time to kind of review the five-year agreement and send it through the review process, whatever form that takes. And I said, well that sounds fine with me. So they did expedite it. You know, some of the high-level folks over asset management talked with OBS, and they, within a few days, they had this amendment with the agreement and this cover letter prepared and sent to me. And I told them when our meeting was, and they said, well, great, if your board can approve this, and I could sign the agreements and provide insurance certificates and various other documents that I need to sign. Overnight mail tomorrow, they'll have it approved by the Department of General Services, and there'll be a seamless transition into the fiscal year. What I didn't mention was, well, the wastewater is still going to flow here after the first of the fiscal year. We're still going to receive and have to treat it. We can't shut it down over the prison. But I didn't leave that, I left that out. But anyways, so this is an amendment for 12 months, and the scope of work, Exhibit A that's attached, it's essentially the scope of work from the current agreement. It's expiring with the date extension in it and some new contact information for people that we send invoices to and interface with the prison. Exhibit B, the budget detail, that's something I prepared, and that's almost identical to what's in the five-year agreement, where we shifted funds from wastewater treatment and the capital debt service into pump station maintenance, where we have, you know, $280,000 in the maintenance to hire the three employees to do the bar screen cleaning. So that's been integrated into this budget, as well as about on page 2 on Exhibit B, $700,000 for construction work for improvements that are currently under design for the electrical instrumentation systems out there. So the funding's in place for these things, and we even added note 3, which says that the funding, $400,000, includes cleaning the influence screen between the certain hours. So our recommendation is to approve the amendment tonight to extend the agreement, and the main question I have then is the board comfortable with CMSA hiring the three employees to do the pump station bar screening work, starting up that recruitment process and hiring them, even though the scope of work says the prison will do that, that we don't do it. But we have the language in the new exhibit that says that funding's there for it. From the state perspective, this is not a legal question, but the state perspective, San Quentin's ready for us to start the work. And the asset management folks, they said if the funding's there, that's what they care about. So it's kind of like a two-part action. One is approve the recommendation, approve the amendment, then some direction on, you know, starting the recruitment, you know, for the new industrial utility labor class of positions that we approved the job description for several months ago.
Can we include that direction in the motion?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I'll move we approve the contract amendment to the San Quentin State Prison, and provide direction to the general manager to start recruitment for hiring the staff needed for implementation.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded. Are there any comments or discussion on the motion?
The recruitment will follow the conditions as outlined in the agreement.
Yeah, in what we, you know, I've talked to our employment law attorney about this. We'd have hire agreements for three individuals that tied the employment to the actual contract with San Quentin.
I saw that inside.
So if something happens, we'd have to let them go, and that'd be part of the agreement process. They would be represented by SEIU, so they'd be in the union. And they'd be, you know, they'd have a certain salary that was approved by the board with a growth range and full agency benefits. And that's all been integrated into the upper end cost in that pump station sub-accounts within the Exhibit B budget detail.
So would we be hiring them as temporary employees then?
They'd be called temporary regular employees is the term.
And then if, say, this was the final agreement that we were approving tonight, would that change their status to just a regular full-time employee?
We'd always keep them temporary.
Because it's a five-year contract.
Because if something, now we don't think anything would happen with the contract, but if something did, or the funding was removed by the state, or they said, oh, now we have, you know, yeah, inmates to do this, we don't need you to do that CMSA, we want to save the monies, then we'd have to let those employees go. We didn't have some.
Well, the last time.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they have very specific conditions and criteria for the hirees.
mm-hmm. when you screen them. So they're probably different than any other stamp.
Yeah, they're going to have to meet security clearance requirements for the state. They're going to have to be able to speak English so they can talk with the folks going into the prison, or if they interface with people at the pump station. There'll be some specific requirements that we don't have in our normal, hiring process.
It's been moved and seconded.
It has been moved and seconded. Any further comments? Okay, all in favor approving the amendment and also starting the recruitment process for the CMSA employees?
Aye.
Aye. Great. Thank you.
Okay, item 10 is a consideration to cancel the August 13th regular board meeting, and staff is recommending that we cancel the meeting.
So moved.
You had no real staff report on this one.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. All in favor of canceling the August board meeting?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, no questions on that?
Nope.
Okay. Item 11 is an informational item about bringing on a retired annuitant employment.
Thank you. Yeah, so, about a little over a year ago, we talked, I briefed the board on a long time electrical instrumentation supervisor, Kit Groves, retiring, and you authorized us to go ahead and start a recruitment process about 6 months early so we can have some staff here for training and transition before Kit left. And that, the whole plan worked out perfectly fine, but the person that we ended up selecting, ended up getting a promotion at another agency, so they didn't come. So we had to go to the next person on the list and brought that person on, and they ended up moving back to Oregon. And now is it three people or four people?
I think we're on our fourth now.
Fourth. So now we have a new individual who we hired, and we talked to Kit before we retired, and we said, well, Kit, you've been away from this 1986, and he's a really sharp guy, and it's all great work, great trainer also. We said, after your retirement 6 months and you meet those CalPERS rules that you can't come back and work with, you'd be interested in coming back and working on some projects, training some of the new employees, helping with some of the backlog on the process control, instrumentation, electrical work at the agency. And he said, he'd like to do that. We didn't know if he meant it or not, but when we called him after 6 months, he answered the phone, and he said, sure, I'll come back. So we wanted to bring him back as an independent contractor. As I mentioned in the staff report, there was a Supreme Court decision at the state level last year that has very specific criteria for independent contractors, and we just couldn't meet that. So I talked with our employment law attorney. She said, well, you can bring him back as a retired annuitant, where you actually hire him, and he's not an employee, but they call it retired annuitant. Mm-hmm. So he can work up to 960 hours a year. You pay him at an equivalent pay rate for the position. So he'd be paid at what his position was before he left with the COLAs that happened since then. Wouldn't get any benefits. And you'd have to limit to 960 hours a year and more kind of project focused. So we mentioned that to him. He said, that sounds great. And so we worked with the employment law attorney to draft this agreement, which kind of references a lot of the CalPERS rules in it. And it's funny, I just sent him the agreement letter here, just for review, and he signed it and sent it back. I didn't have my signature on it yet. So then we prepared the task list that's attached, which has hours and cost estimates. And he's excited to start on July 1st and come back working on special projects on this list. He'd report to Chris, our plant manager, and I was talking to Dean about this. He's the first time we hired, and I said, do you think I should bring this to the board and as an approval item or just mention the normal report? And Dean thought, why don't you bring it with the staff report and as informational and just get some feedback, if anything. So that's kind of what our plan is.
Great skill sets.
Yeah, I think this is awesome. I think it's a win-win.
It's totally a win-win. And as a former employee of the state of California, the agency I worked for used retired annuitants extensively. So I've had a lot of experience with this program, and we should not limit it to this one person. Be open-minded about other opportunities that are out there.
That's great stuff. Okay.
Yeah, it's a great program because they work basically part time, and if they want to take trips or travel or whatever they want to do, it's very because as you say, it's very project focused. So, Yeah, it's a great thing. I'm ready to vote in favor of it when everyone...
I don't think we have to vote.
It's information.
Oh, it's information, okay.
I think we could have voted if we didn't want to do it. Yeah, we talked about it again yesterday, and I think it's a great idea. So.
Great.
Big support.
Good job.
All right, excellent, thank you.
Okay, any other comments for Jason?
No.
Okay, moving on to item 12. June information logs.
Yeah, just you know, we have these as regular items, you know, as part of the packet. So if you wanted to talk about it or any questions and stuff, I could you do that. But I don't have a particular staff report for any of these items.
I'd just like to comment on item 12B is that Commissioner Kelly and Jason and I reviewed the as part of our ad hoc property master plan subcommittee. Ad hoc committee. We toured the property and sort of, and also up on the hillside above here, and sort of are getting a map of the whole area and see what we have available, just total CMSA property wise. In that discussion, in that review, we also just discussed the leasing of the property to the airporter, and that's the genesis of this David Tattersall and Company agreement, is to begin that appraisal process and basically updating the previous appraisal that he has done for us and bring that. And so we're looking at the Marine Airporter property agreement in the collection of our master plan as well. So that's really what this is coming from.
I believe that Marine Airporter has agreed to pay for that appraisal.
Yes. Yeah, they were fine with using a David.
There's no cost to us.
Yeah, and we sent over the, you know, the cost information. They said that's fine, and so go ahead and sign the agreement. CMSA will cover the cost of that.
Right. Which all sounds great, and the subcommittee or the special committee will be looking at the broader property potential.
Yes. Yeah.
Can I mention that we took a little drive?
Four wheeling.
It almost was. For the record, you know, I could take any of you, or any of us could take, the three of us could take you out and point out what's our property. It's 40 acres, perhaps. You have to go through the back of Marin Sanitary Services, right, and use their ropes. Right. They were kind enough to kind of put down some gravel on our part. There's a couple of flat spaces, and it's like, oh Lord, this is, I mean, one's got like 280 degree of the water. It's really, really quite nice. But I don't know what we could do with it. Because for one thing, we stopped right where they're doing the second repair, the big repair. And Jason was going to stop, I'm sure, but I was like, and I think we all were like, whoa, hit the brakes. Because had he gone like 3 feet more, we would have rolled.
I was trying to scare him.
Yeah. But it was all through basically woods that had an old trail, but nobody drew it on the trail, so we were knocking down bushes the whole way. It's like this, most of it. It's just, you know, very steep, and then you get to the top, and there are a couple of flat places. I don't know what we could do with it. And the only thing after I decided that we probably couldn't do anything is, well, maybe it's good that nobody's there because they're not going to complain about the sewer system. You know, it's just, they're not going to say it stinks up here. But it's a lot of property. I don't know. I'm not saying it couldn't be done something with it.
Which is an interesting point about the odors. I understand that there may be development limitations on it, on that property, as part of the siting permission that San Rafael granted.
Okay.
So we might, due to odors, but this was, of course, done many years ago before we put in the advanced odor controls. So. But it might be an issue that we would have to look at. But are we satisfied that there's no development potential to that property?
I can't, unless there's, I would be happy to have somebody professional come in and take a look at it. I'm not a professional. I don't think there's much development, but I could be wrong. But I don't think so.
We have to start looking at the zoning of it, and yeah. I don't even know if it's zoned for residential or if it's just service commercial property that goes along with this whole corridor.
I mean, you could
and also there's ridgeline protections, I think, that we have.
Yeah, but one of the flat places didn't have a ridgeline. I mean, in theory, you could build a commercial building there, but how would you get to it?
Well, let's take this one step at a time. Let's see if it's physically possible to build something there.
Yeah.
And if so, what that might be. And then we'll go deal with our friends at the city of San Rafael and see what they might be amenable to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But let's take it one step at a time and see if, because that's a lot of property.
It is.
It seems.
It wasn't a typo.
Yeah, it seems like there should be some use.
Oh, I'm not. Yeah, I know. This was just an initial assessment, mm-hmm. and I'm sure if you brought. I mean, I've seen hillsides built, or things built on hillsides steeper than that.
Yeah.
But it is. It's. Things could be built on. There are a lot of mini slides all throughout it, though. Trees are like this. We're repairing slides there. Mm-hmm. So there's evidence of a lot of slide activity. And it'd be, you know, geotechs would have to get in there and look at it and all that. So, but we've just done the first reconnaissance.
Yes. Right. Reconnaissance, okay.
And so that's sort of where we are right now.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Informational items. Okay, the North Bay Watershed Association report. Michael.
I'll keep it very short, but it was very cool. Paula Kehoe from the San Francisco PUC. It's a very old system, San Francisco, from the, she went over, you know, what they have with the Hetch Hetchy. So they have three different groups out there. They have power, is one group. Water is another group, and wastewater is another group, and they are all completely separate entities. And due to the way it's been set up over the years, it's what they call siloed, and none of them are allowed to talk to each other.
This is SFPUC?
Yeah. And that's turning into a very big problem because it doesn't allow them to move forward and do some very extremely cool things. And so they really are looking for this one water approach to the San Francisco PUC and have everything be under one group. Even so far as all of their water, 100% of it comes from Hetch Hetchy right now. And they have gone back and discovered that at a very shallow distance underground, there's big aquifers under Golden Gate Park, and those windmills that are there could easily produce high quality water for the city without having to transport it all the way from Hetch Hetchy. It's not going to take over the whole water supply for the city, but a lot. So they're looking at that. They're looking to every building that goes in now, they're double plumbing. So like the Salesforce Tower apparently is double plumbed, so they can be using recycled water there. Golden Gate Park is not plumbed for recycled water. And so they're looking at doing that, to do all of the watering in Golden Gate Park with recycled water. It's just a lot of very, very cool things that they're doing there. And also, they, like everybody else, have to sell bonds to finance. But they're doing green bond financing, that they're selling bonds for their whole green energy program. And people really like that. That people are like willing, apparently, to pay a premium. Anyway, they did this, so I snagged one copy of it for us. I'll leave it here with the agency and take a look at it. It's very pretty. There was another fellow, the Water Resources Development, WRDA. Traditionally, the Army Corps of Engineers do a certain kind of a project. Like the RA, which has to do with like restoration of marshes and other things, but having to do with waterways. And so they hadn't really considered that Highway 37 issue that could be considered not just a transportation issue under the realm of transportation agencies, but really could also be considered as reclaiming that entire North Bay watershed that was for hay farming in the 1800s to feed the horses. And so they're investigating, Damon Connolly is working on that, the possibility of presenting the idea to the Army Corps much like the salt flats were done in the South Bay, to say, hey, you know, let's just raise up 37, which would then make that whole northern marshland breathe with every tide issue back and forth. And maybe we could get the Army Corps and the feds to pay for part of that Highway 37, which they're going to have to do soon because every winter time it's flooding and shutting down.
And how many miles is that?
Jason,
22
miles, yeah.
Okay, that's going to be
big job.
Expensive.
Well, it's a big job. I mean, they know they have to do it. That's not an issue of if. It's a matter of they got to do it. But if you can do it partially under the guise of we're reclaiming the marshlands up there, sea level rise, it will be incredibly important for the health of Napa and Sonoma and Petaluma to have that marshland be able to absorb some of the sea level rise. So they're looking into that as a possibility of getting some help funding. That was it.
Okay, thank you. All reports by commissioners and general manager.
My report was going to be our little jaunt, and we'll talk about that. Okay. We'll dry the woods.
Okay, just a few things real quick, my handout. When I was invited to go to Chicago in September and give a presentation on our organic waste program, Power Resilient Program, so I'll probably go out there with a big panel on one of the pre-workshops for the Water and Environment Technology Conference and just go for the weekend and give the presentation, be part of the workshop, and then come back. So I'm looking forward to that. Then we have some interns. You see, we have an intern from Robert High, and we have an intern from Novato, and we have a Dominican University intern that will be starting here pretty soon in the lab. And then there's a couple of these bills that I mentioned in the past. One, the Hertzberg bill about ocean discharge. You have to find a home for, you know, 50% of your, you got admitted to annual dry weather flow volume. That went, since it has a cost more than $150,000, when it went to appropriations, it was put in their suspense file, and it never came out of their file when they looked at the all items in there, so it kind of died. And then CASA's flushable wipes legislation, it was in appropriations, and they're also in the suspense file, but what they did is they made it a two-year bill. So that's something they rarely do, I understand. So the bill's going to be amended, and it will be brought back to appropriations in January and reintroduced for that legislative session. But it doesn't have to go through the Assembly's policy committees. It just goes to appropriations, and it passes out of there. It goes to the full Assembly for a vote.
Yeah, the crow wipes lobby got thrown.
That's what happened. And that's all I had.
I might also just mention that Doug Kelly and another board member have been doing public outreach for the Ross Valley Sanitary Districts, and we have advertisements that have been running on Comcast local stations. And during the Warrior game, I think it was the wipes.
Yep, which it was the fogs and the wipes.
Yeah, fogs and wipes that was played during the Warriors game. I don't know which Warriors.
It was the.
It was one where they wiped them.
It was the last series, not
where
this series.
Where we got wiped?
Because we said
Friday's game, right?
We said the finals, and they thought that meant the Western finals. It's like, oh, but the finals are the finals. But anyway, it doesn't matter because Comcast doesn't control the finals.
Yeah.
So we're in the Western finals. We had to two commercials.
Jason, what is BABC for the chemical procurement contract?
Oh, that's the Bay Area Chemical Consortium.
Yeah, cool. Thank they buy chemicals for, but not that one chemical.
Not Palmer.
Not Palmer.
Okay. Next meeting is July 9th.
Thank you.
Okay. Meeting adjourned.
Just let you know that I'm going on a family vacation to Maui on Sunday, so I'll be gone for, you know, like 10 days. Just let you guys know.